to center. Back at the wall. It is gone. What a start. Dexter Fowler, hello, in game seven. Santana to pull. He does. Tie game. High fly ball into right center. Davis came in, goes back. Well, get there off the wall. In to score is Zobrist, and the lead is two. It's 3-1. Fly ball into right center. Back at the wall. Lester. Lindor bounces in. It hits Ross. The run scores. Here comes Kipnis. He's safe. It's 5-3. Ross flies one into center. Sends Davis back at the wall. It's gone. The 39-year-old in his final game. Line drive into right center field. That ball's down. Taken around third, Ramirez. He will score on an RBI double by Brandon Guyer. It's 6-4. Drawn into left. The wall. It's gone. Tie game. Rosie Davis. 6-6. Zobrist. That's a base hit. Cubs will take the lead. That's a base hit. Rizzo scores. Zobrist is held. 8-6 Chicago. Into center field, another hit. Here comes Guyer. The throw into second. It's a one-run game. Davis delivers again. The one. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series. Bryant makes the play. It's over. And the Cubs have finally won it all.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome, indeed, to the extravaganza. Our apologies, by the way, for the late start to the show. It's already 3:18. We had all kinds of technical difficulties getting everything up and running. And I guess maybe that's par for the course. Maybe that's kind of to be expected on a day like today. On a day like today, we go from the highest of highs. I'm going to kill that music there, Jim. We go from the highest of highs. A 3-1 World Series lead. Jim, you want to kill that music for me there, pal? All right, thank you. Because we need something that's a little bit more appropriate for what happened last night. Once again, as the drought continues for the Cleveland Indians.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland too.
Many times throughout the course of these playoffs, Jim Cushlin has put together highlight packages featuring the victory song from the movie Major League from 1989.
Heck, the one you're playing right now, I tried to turn into a good thing back in June when the Cavs won.
Which, of course, is not the way it really is. This is if you're taking life here and trying to imitate art, and this is art from 1989. This is, of course, the opening song to the movie Major League, when obviously the Indians were just losers, pure unadulterated losers. They were just a wreck. Lowest attendance in baseball. You remember the theme. The owner, the witch of an owner, wanted to lose as many games as possible to get attendance down so she can move the team to Miami. And this was just the music from the loser theme, or the loser theme music, I guess, from the city before the dramatic turnaround and the championship at the end of that wonderful movie from 1989. And so I had this in my mind. Because Burn On Big River, of course, is reference to the burning Cuyahoga River, which, of course, made that city a national laughingstock in the late 1970s. And that's kind of how a lot of Indians fans are feeling right now. Feeling like their river is burning out there in Cleveland once again. That the negativity is back. That even the losers from Wrigleyville, who hadn't won a championship since 1908. Even they have a championship before the Indians do.
Burn on, big river, burn on.
And they have that championship, of course, at the expense of the Indians, which just adds so much more to the misery that the Cleveland Indians now have the dubious distinction of being the team with the single longest world championship drought in all of Major League Baseball. That 1948 mark will now be the new 1908, now that the Cubs have ended their horrifically long wait. Now that that is over, it is all about the Indians' wait. And I know a lot of folks just felt really down and depressed about that late last night, certainly this morning, talking to a lot of people, a lot of friends and family who have been grown up as I did and as Jim Cushlin did as Indians fans. There's a lot of people who just feel really depressed and feeling sorry for themselves right about now. The Cavaliers came back in June from a 3-1 deficit to the Golden State Warriors and won the NBA championship. And in the process, what did many of us do? We laughed and made fun of the Golden State Warriors. And we made fun of their fans because they were already counting their second straight championship, capping off their 73-win regular season and NBA record. And we mocked them for blowing a 3-1 lead that the Cavaliers just stormed back and took from them. And to see the tables turn now in this baseball World Series just four short months later is very, very disheartening, and it's very, very discouraging. And I'm not one for a lot of emotional, moral victories. I'm just not that guy. You know, there's a winner and there's a loser in every game, and there's a winner and there's a loser in every series. And history will record that the Chicago Cubs are the winners and that the Cleveland Indians are the losers. But I would be doing a disservice, I think, to all of the fans and most importantly to the players from that organization if I didn't at least offer a little bit of perspective here to the fact that the Cubs are the winners and the Indians are the losers. And I will not be moral victory guy, but I will say this. When you have no business being where you are, and you're there anyway, then I'm sorry, you're not a loser. When you are so undermanned because of injuries, when you are completely outclassed position by position, in really all three of the world of the series during the playoffs and the World Series that you had to compete in, when you are the underdog in each of them, the underdog against the highest scoring team in baseball, or in the American League anyway, the Boston Red Sox, the underdog against the free-swinging, long ball-driving Toronto Blue Jays, and when you're the underdog against the 103-win Chicago Cubs, and yet you beat those Red Sox, and you beat those Blue Jays, and you go seven games to the 10th inning with those Chicago Cubs, history will record you as the loser, but I will not refer to you as losers. I will not refer to us as fans of that franchise as losers. I said this after, I think it might have been the Red Sox series, and Cushlin can confirm or not. Not that it matters that much. But I said at the time, find me another franchise among the other 29 in Major League Baseball. And we use the Tigers as an example. But find me another franchise that could lose their best all-around player for virtually the entire season, save for 11 games. That's all Michael Brantley played. He played in 11 games. He's their best all-around hitter for power, for average, clutch, virtually everything. Outstanding defensive player, massive presence in that locker room and in that clubhouse and in that dugout. Michael Brantley's their best player. Take two of their top three starting pitchers in the rotation off of any other franchise while taking their best hitter out of the game. Because that's what Carlos Carrasco, the number two starter, and Danny Salazar, the number three starter. And you could even flip-flop those in the first half. Danny Salazar had such a great first half, he was an all-star. You might have put him at number two. Either way, two of the top three starters unavailable for the last month of the season and for all of the playoffs. And yes, I'm counting Salazar's couple of brief relief appearances in this World Series, but unavailable for all of the playoffs, both of those guys, to start games. Find me another team that could lose their best hitter and two of their top three starters and still get to the World Series, Game 7, a series that you played so closely against the team that history will record as the winners, that literally you scored the identical amount of runs in seven games as they did, 27 and 27. The difference being one run in the 10th inning of Game 7, deciding the winner and the loser. Find me another franchise that could have gotten that done under those circumstances. And I do not believe that any other team would have made it to the World Series, let alone been in a position to win the World Series with three bites at that apple in games 5, 6, and 7. So I'm not moral victory guy, but I am also not just accept Loserville guy if the tag doesn't apply either. And what the Indians franchise did in the course of this last month, really since the turn of the calendar into October, taking fans on a wild ride as the Triple G's they are, undermanned and outclassed by the Red Sox, Blue Jays, and Cubs, but to come within a run and extra innings of Game 7 in one of the most dramatic finishes in World Series history. The Triple G's, the gritty, gutty grinders from out there in Cleveland, for them to take their fans on that run is to give them a reason to walk with their heads held high. There are no losers in this series, despite the fact that history will record a winner and a loser. As Terry Francona said, somebody had to win and somebody had to lose. We get it. We understand it.
That was quite a series, and you knew somebody was going to go home happy, but they deserve a lot of congratulations.
History will record somebody had to win and somebody had to lose. Absolutely. But you know what? There were no losers in that series because nobody else would have even gotten that far. And that's what I'm going to take away from this. That's how I'm going to make myself feel better about it. I posted on Facebook earlier this morning that the sun had come up. Even though it was overcast and cloudy, there was still a sun up. It wasn't dark. It wasn't dark skies anymore. The sun had come up today, like it always does, and like it always will, despite you going to bed last night, if you are an Indians fan, going to bed and falling asleep in despair and feeling like it might be the end of the world, the sun came up, as it always will. And that is the bounding optimism that I think that fans of the Indians should have going forward, because the sun is very, very bright ahead of the Cleveland Indians. That franchise is not going anywhere. That franchise isn't breaking up. There aren't a bunch of pieces that are going to be sold off. The core of the franchise is all signed under long-term contracts, almost all of them. And there are others who I promise you will absolutely be happy to sign extended deals when their time comes up, because what they had is very, very special. What they had in not just the playoff run, but in the season, 94 wins, and really they never relinquished first place from, I don't remember when it was, Jim, but sometime in mid-May. In mid-May, they held on to it through all of June, all of July, all of August, all of September, and obviously the playoff run, which was incredible. They are built to continue to be the American League Central champion for the foreseeable future. Barring some dramatic improvement by the Detroit Tigers or a return to the 2015 and 2014 form of the Kansas City Royals, I have no reason whatsoever to think that Corey Kluber and a healthy Carlos Carrasco and a healthy Danny Salazar and a healthy Josh Tomlin and a healthy Trevor Bauer and more mature Trevor Bauer and a bullpen that is just ridiculous, I have no reason to think that it won't continue to be the best rotation in baseball and that it won't continue to win 90-plus games a year for the next several years. The sun came up this morning. The sun will continue to rise on that franchise, on that team's fortunes, and that's how I exit the 2016 World Series. So I just kind of wanted to lay that out a little bit in monologue format. We're going to get the thoughts of Dennis Manilov here in just a minute. As a matter of fact, we're going to get to a quick timeout here now and get a SportsCenter update for you and get Manilov on the program to see how things looked up close and personal. He, of course, was in Cleveland and was at the ballpark. The rest of us watched on TV. But I want to get his thoughts on that, too. And I also want to get his thoughts and yours at 866-240-1065 when the opportunity arises and we open up the phone lines. On this notion that what we saw last night might have been the greatest Game 7 in World Series history. And they've been talking about it on the national level like that for, you know, obviously the last 12 hours or so, and 12 hours plus. People have been saying greatest Game 7 in World Series history. I'm going to take very, very serious issue with that. It was not the greatest Game 7 in World Series history. It might have been one of the most dramatic Game 7s in series or playoff histories, but it was not a great game because it wasn't played great by either the winning team or the losing team, and I'll explain that. It wasn't managed in a great way by either the winning team or the losing team, and I'll explain that. But I want your thoughts on what we saw last night, what we saw, and what it says about baseball is one of baseball's most enduring storylines, which is, you know, the ongoing 100-plus-year odyssey without a championship of the Cubs. Is that drought ending good for baseball, or is that something that is bad for baseball now that that enduring storyline is going to be gone and is gone going forward? Is that something that baseball will kind of come to regret after its celebration of the moment in the future? How will they feel about that? So I want to get into all of that. Manilov coming your way right after we get a timeout here. Your phone calls as well. Kushner will join us as well right here as we get you rolling on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
A France extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we, on the extravaganza right here. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, trying to pick up the pieces this afternoon. And you know, I started it this morning with the positive vibes that I was able to give. I want to welcome Dennis Manilov, who saw everything up close and personal last night at Progressive Field. The rest of us had to experience it on television and had to endure more Joe Buck. But the folks out in Cleveland had a much better look at it. And D-Man, first of all, thanks for joining us. D-Man, of course, is a great friend of the show, and he covers Cleveland sports for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. D-Man, your feelings at this moment right now, looking back at last night?
Hey, yeah. You know, it's obviously rough for Northeast Ohio, and, you know, it's difficult for the fan base, no question about it. You know, I'm in the media, I write about the Indians, but I'm a Northeast Ohio guy, so, and a fan of the Indians since I was 7. So, you know, it's a punch to the gut, but what I've tried to do as quickly as possible is step back and recognize, number one, what a fantastic season the Indians had. Number two, what a great series this was for baseball. And you know, it really was a glorious 2 weeks for baseball. I'm not saying the postseason in general wasn't good, but this is the World Series that baseball needed, I believe, to give it a turbo boost.
In what way, Dennis, is it because it was a 7-game series, or is it because of the storyline of the team with the longest title drought playing the team with the second longest title drought? What is it that made this particular 2 weeks and this World Series, you know, the boost for baseball?
Well, you had the perfect storm. You had the two, you know, Wolvergone franchises, if you will, in terms of chasing the title. They meet up. You know, they're both Midwest. You have the prohibitive favorite in the Cubs and the plucky underdog in the Indians. So you had all the ingredients. Now the only question was, would the series go long enough either way to be, now most people thought, you know, if it was going to be a short series, the Cubs were going to win it. If it was going to go deep, it would, you know, that would be the Indians' potential. But it had to go long enough to be compelling. And it turned out to be the case, you know, 7 games and the 7th game in extra innings. And, you know, to just ricochet back to the pain of the Cleveland Indians fan, I mean, think about how is it in a span of 20 years that 2 World Series games, game 7s, are go to extra innings and your team loses them both. And I don't know if any other World Series Game 7 has gone to extra innings between that. I'm sure there's probably one of them in there somewhere. but it's hard to believe that the same franchise has had two Game 7 extra inning losses in the World Series.
Dennis Baniloff joining us from Cleveland, Ohio, talking about Game number 7 last night. This game has been described by many people on the national stage over the last 12-plus hours as the greatest Game 7 in World Series history, even eclipsing 1960 and Maz, even eclipsing Luis Gonzalez beating the Yankees. So many great Game 7s that we can call to mind. There are many who say this is the greatest Game 7 ever. I think that's hogwash, and I'm not saying that because I'm a bitter fan of the team that lost the game. I just think great Game 7 should be filled with great plays, and this Game 7 yesterday was filled with so many bad plays, bad decisions, three errors, a missed bunt, third strike, all kinds of things that just should not have happened. It was a great drama. There was a lot of drama. It was one of those most dramatic Game 7s, especially the way that it ended, but it was not greatly played, and in my mind, when I talk about a great game, I'm talking about two teams at their best, just one of them making one great play after the other and answering the other, not one of them just trying to overcome their own mistakes from the inning before.
I hear you. I hear you, Bob, on that. You know, if you want to talk about, you know, best played or best executed games, you're right. It wouldn't be on the list, but for drama, for I guess the human element that, you know, when you envelope mistakes in, I mean, there were plenty of good swings, there were plenty of good pitches, but there were also the mistakes. So you had the cornucopia. You had basically everything that baseball had to offer kind of all thrown into one game with the pressure of the World Series on the line. That's what made it so compelling. You know, the ultimate elimination game had everything, including that mini rain delay, which the Cubs, you know, credited for helping them. I mean, you couldn't have asked for much more packed into one game, and I think that's why it's getting the rave reviews that it is.
Yeah, and like I said, from that standpoint, action-packed and the drama and everything else, I get. I mean, the fact that Rajah Davis is able to drive that one out in the eighth inning, when it just seemed like the Indians were always trying to climb out of a hole that they could never quite get all the way out of, Rajah Davis draws even. And, I mean, that place exploded. I just leaped off my couch. I couldn't believe what I had just seen. And I was this close to going to wake up the kids who had gone to bed because it's a school night and say, oh, my God, you guys are going to win this thing. And I'm glad I held off. I was figured I'd wait until it was over and the comeback was complete. But then for the Cubs to come right back and to plate two more. And then again, to never say die. And in the bottom of the 10th to get one more and put the tying run on base. It really was a lot of drama. But there were just so many mistakes made by both teams, most of them by the team that ended up winning. As I mentioned, a wild pitch that scores two, three errors in the game, telling a guy or giving the guy the freedom to choose whether he wants to try to bunt with two strikes and ending up getting a strikeout. The mystifying decision by one of the game's great managers to bring John Lester in with a runner on first. When he's the guy who absolutely does not want to be brought into a game with a runner on. He likes to start his innings clean because he can't throw over there, which, of course, ended up costing them when Ross had to come and field the dribbler in front of the plate because Lester couldn't go touch it because he'd never be able to make the throw. All of those mistakes, Dennis, were made by the winning team, and they somehow got by them. And it's a championship, and it's a victory, but it's almost like they had to get out of their own way.
Yeah, they were fortunate. I was also getting ready, if the Indians had won, to thank Joe Maddon for pulling the plug on John Lester after the infield single by Ramirez with two outs and going to Chapman, because I felt like Lester was dominating, really, and that infield single was nothing special.
Dennis, that Hendricks was dominating before he went to Lester. It was a very short leash on Hendricks. I would have left him there. I mean, the Indians weren't showing any gusto against him. It didn't like they were, you know, finally starting to reach him. It was a walk that knocked him out of the game.
Yeah. Right. And I think when the Cubs look back at this World Series, they're going to look at the conglomerate. They'll look at the seven-game deal. They're not going to, as you say, the Game 7 won't be in their Hall of Fame of greatest games ever played. because of the mistakes. But at the same time, though, look at some of the improbabilities that came from the Chicago Cubs in Game 7 that allowed them to overcome the mistakes. I point to David Ross hitting a home run off Andrew Miller. If you would have told anyone before the Game 7 started that David Ross would homer off Andrew Miller, and oh, by the way, it would factor heavily in the outcome, you would have been laughed at, okay? The 10th inning, I mean, think about it. Yes, Schwarber starts it out with this, with a ripped single, and by the way, Schwarber was an enormous factor in this series.
It's no doubt.
The main reason the Indians lost 3 out of 4 at Progressive Field is because the Cubs had the DH, and the DH was Schwarber. But you look later in the 10th inning, I mean, Ben Zobrist, two-hop chopper, sharply hit, but a two-hopper past the diving Jose Ramirez. Rarely does Ben Zobrist hit a grounder to the left side. Then you got Miguel Montero, of all guys, slapping a single to the left side, a left-handed hitter going to the left side for an RBI. Those are your two, and Zobrist turned out to be a double. Montero's was a single. Those turn out to be your two RBI hits in the decisive 10th inning for the Cubs. So, you know, there were plenty of guys that helped. Who was the last guy on the mound for the Chicago Cubs? Carl Edwards Jr. I mean, really? So.
Yeah, well, they had to
Yankee. No, they took him out, right.
Yeah, they had to get Montgomery to finish it.
Montgomery got the last up, but Edwards Jr. and Montgomery to finish up. I mean, think about that. So, you know, if you would have gone into the game, you would have thought, okay, Kluber to Miller to Allen, and the Cubs will go Hendricks to somebody to Chapman, and instead you're ending up the way they ended up. So, but again, the bottom line, Bob, is in the overarching deal for baseball, it's a beautiful thing. For the Cubs, it's wonderful. For the Indians, not so much.
Dennis Mantloff breaking down Game 7 of the World Series yesterday. The Cubs' 108-year drought is over. The Indians' 68-year drought will become 69. Dennis, one of the most amazing things about this game for me is the untouchable pitchers that got touched. You know, Corey Kluber was simply dominant this entire postseason, and particularly in two starts in this World Series in Games 1 and 4. And he goes four innings without a strikeout, the first major league game he's ever appeared in, if I heard that correctly, in which he has not recorded a single strikeout, and he gets touched up. Andrew Miller was the MVP of the ALCS and was just as dominant in his appearances thus far, gets touched up. Aroldis Chapman, thanks in part to Joe Maddon's mystifying decision to pitch him 20 pitches in Game 6 with a 5-run lead, is not himself, is not at full strength, or is not whatever he needed to be. And he, of course, gives up the bomb to Davis. The guys that were untouchable were touched, and it took the secondary guys on both teams, really, to finally decide this one. And that's, to me, you know, just such an indication of obviously fatigue. I don't think it was anything to do with nerves in any of their cases. I think sometimes it's fatigue, and sometimes it's you see a guy often enough, and as many innings and as many ABs as they did Kluber and even Miller, eventually the advantage has got to shift to the hitter, and he's going to understand what he's going to get in what counts, what pitch he's going to see in what counts, and he's going to be ready for it. He's going to watch his own video and see what he swung and missed on before and where it was and which ones he should take. And I think all of those things played a huge factor, the fatigue factor and the recognition factor, particularly for Kluber and Miller.
100%. 100% agree. I mean, there's no question the Cleveland Indians left everything they had on the field. That's not trophies for everybody mentality. That's the reality of it. They shouldn't be disappointed or upset with their performance, even though they were up 3-1 and couldn't close the deal. This is not a choke. This is not a giveaway. The Cubs ripped it from them by playing really well in games 5, 6, and 7. Granted, as you said, and didn't execute particularly well in game 7, but overall, games 5 through 7, the Cubs got it done. Specifically 6 and 7 at the plate. And, you know, when you talk about, all right, if hitters see a pitcher enough, well, especially if they're good hitters, all right?
Right.
Cubs lineup is loaded with good young hitters, and they wear you down. And you know, you look at a Schwarber who comes off the deck, you know, for being out an entire season and dominates at bats. I thought Bryant was spectacular once he locked in after that first home run that he hit. He was tremendous the remainder of the series. Rizzo was an absolute pain in the rear for the Cleveland Indians. As you say, Zobrist, MVP. I'm amazed that, and I say this only in quotes, that they only scored 27 runs in the series. As good as that lineup is, and that's a credit to the Indians pitching staff. And by the way, Bob, the final run tally, Tubbs, 27, Indians, 27. So,
yeah, it doesn't get, it can't get any closer, obviously. And you're right. And here's the thing, Dennis, that really, really, again, impresses me the most about the team that will go down as the losers of the 2016 World Series. And I hate to say that, but somebody is a winner and somebody's a loser. I don't believe in participation ribbons. The Indians are the losers of the World Series. But I cannot call them losers in any way, shape, or form because of what you just said. It was 27-27. It took seven games. It took extra innings in the seventh game, and there was only one run difference in that game. And the difference between the teams was light years. The Indians played without their best hitter for the entire season and for all of the postseason, and that's Michael Brantley, which impacts everything. And then they played this postseason without two of their top three starters in the rotation, in Carrasco and Salazar. Salazar got some spot duty in relief, but was not the starter, and they had to go at this thing with only three starters, with Kluber, with Tomlin, and with Bauer. So when you look at it in that context, with the Cubs having one of baseball's best young lineups, and one of the game's great managers, and one of the great rosters, and the 103 wins and everything else, the Indians had no business being 27-27 in runs scored and a one-run difference in the 10th inning of the seventh game of this World Series.
Yeah, it would have been a colossal upset if the Cleveland Indians had pulled this off, and they came up just short. But yeah, you can't help but think, and this is not an excuse, it's just reality. Or you think about this, if you're from the Cleveland perspective, imagine if Brantley had been able to come back for the World Series like Schwarber did for the Cubs. All right, let's say Schwarber wasn't able to come back and Brantley was. Would the series have been different? I pretty much can assure you that it would have been. Carrasco. Don't even give me Salazar. Just give me Carrasco. Give me Carrasco for two starts in the series. Kluber only has to start twice. Tomlin is limited to one start. So all of a sudden your rotation is so much deeper. But again, I mean, injuries happen. It just, in the case of the Indians, it did run them down. You know, the longer the series got, the more their lack of depth hurt. And when you take out your best hitter to start the season and your second best starter, it's hard to overcome when the opponent is the Chicago Cubs.
No question about it. And last thing we'll leave you with here, Dennis, is this. One thing that I don't think anybody can dispute, the Indians will again be the favorites to win the Central Division next year if everybody is healthy and it's a Kluber, Carrasco, Salazar, Tomlin and Bauer, or Bauer and Tomlin rotation, with the best bullpen in baseball coming back, and a healthy Yan Gomes, with a healthy Michael Brantley. There's no doubt they will be the favorite and could very well be the favorite in the American League. We know that the Cubs are built for long-term success. These kids are 22, 23, 24. I think the grand old man in their starting lineup and their batting order is 27. I mean, that team is poised to go on a run and could be dynastic. Do you agree, and do you think that we could very well see what we saw in the NBA, potentially a rematch of the teams that made the finals?
Well, sure, you'd like to think that. And, you know, for the Indians, if I'm the Indians, you know, in the sorrowful state that I'm in right now, you know, being down, I point to two things. Number one, the Cavs of 15 facing Golden State, losing a worn-down Cavaliers, an injury-riddled Cavs, gritty-gutty, take the 2-1 lead, eventually lose 4-2, come back the next year healthy, and battle the same team and wind up winning. Okay, so I draw inspiration from the 15 Cavaliers, but I also, in my own sport, draw inspiration from the Kansas City Royals. The Royals of 14 go to the World Series. They lose to the Giants and Mad Bum. You know, tough, grinded out battle of a series. And guess what? The Royals come back, Midwestern team, not an exorbitant payroll. They come back in 15 and they win, you know, I don't think they won the division that year, I want to say, but they get back to the World Series and finish it off against the Mets. So in your own division, you can look at a team that did in fact recover from a gut busting World Series loss in 14 and come back the next year and win it. So it is possible, but I do say that the Cubs chances are better because they look like they're built to last, and they also have the payroll flexibility to handle, you know, more high-end talent staying around longer.
Dennis Manilov trying to make some sense of it all. A very, very sad night, but a very, very bright future, including the immediate future. And I cannot wait for February and pitchers and catchers to report. Dennis Manilov, great stuff from Cleveland there. Thanks for joining us all season long as we talked about it. And obviously, we'll stay in touch with you as the NFL season moves into the second half as well.
And thanks, Bob. And by the way, thank you, LeBron James, for winning in June, because if that had not happened, I can't even imagine. I probably wouldn't have been able to speak with you today.
I said the same thing to Jim Cushlin before we came on the air, Dennis. Can you imagine if it had not been for the block, the shot, and the stop in Game 7 to win that, and the Cavs had lost the NBA Finals 4 months before the Indians blow a 3-1 lead in the World Series, and would have been now another year, 53 years without a major title in that city. The OIC moments piling up on top of one another, the drive, the fumble, followed by now the collapse and whatever we would have called the loss in the NBA Finals. I mean, my God, the fact that they did that, honestly, is the only thing that takes the sting out of all of this.
Exactly.
Great stuff, Dennis. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you. There's Dennis Manilov joining us. You know what else is pleasurable? Winning things, especially when you get to go to watch the national championship game January 9th in Tampa, and that trip is up for grabs. If you are the grand prize winner, we'll send you to Tampa. Trip for two, round-trip airfare, four-night hotel stay with two upper-level tickets to the championship game, rental car with parking, and a tour of the Yuengling Brewery in Tampa. It's a $5,000 prize package, and we're giving it away to somebody. If you don't win it, you could be the runner-up winner, in which you could get two tickets to the Michigan-Ohio State game at the Horseshoe November 26 with limo service, or you could win a prize package from Yuengling. To qualify, we're going to ask you to be caller number 5 right now to 866-240-1065. You'll be in that grand prize drawing. 866-240-1065. You can also register online at 1065theticket.com. Good luck from Yuengling Lager, Yark Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram, Country Hearth Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air at Toledo Express Airport, Total Image Limousine, and of course your friends here at Toledo's ESPN 1065 The Ticket. All right, we're going to shift gears a little bit on the other side. We're going to talk a little bit college football. We're going to talk a little bit coming up at the bottom of the hour, by the way, speaking of college football, with head coach Mike Jinks. He will join us at about 4:35 or so to talk about Bowling Green and the loss yesterday to Northern Illinois. A very, very rough season for them continues. And hopefully get some of your phone calls in next as well, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That's in the air to center. Back at the wall. It is gone. What a start. Dexter Fowler, hello, in game 7. Santana to pull. He does. Tie game. Fly ball into right center. Back at the wall. Off the bat of Baez. 4-1. Lester. Lindor bounces in. It hits Ross. A run scores. Here comes Kipnis. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series. Bryant makes the play. It's over. And the Cubs have finally won it all.
Snap, JT Barrett. Hands Curtis Samuel, runs it into the end zone. Touchdown, Curtis Samuel of Ohio State, his fifth rushing touchdown of the year. And that gives Ohio State a 23-17 lead over Northwestern.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And onward we roll. Almost just a little add-on of Ohio State football for you there at the end of the montage, because we, of course, have to pay respects to the victors. You know what? You've got to be big in victory and in defeat. And when you are a fan of the Cleveland Indians, as I am, as Jim Cushlin is, you know what? You're sad, you're disappointed, but you got to tip your cap to the victors. They outplayed the Indians in game number 7. They outplayed them, quite frankly, in games 5, 6, and 7, and their drought is over. So congratulations to the Northsiders in Chicago, and it'll be another opportunity. February cannot get here soon enough for me to get pitchers and catchers back there reporting, hopefully all of them healthy this time around, to have another bite at that apple. But you did hear a little bit of Buckeyes at the end of the montage, because that signals the shift in the transition to college football talk right here on the Extravaganza. If it's Thursday and if it's 4 o'clock or 4:10, that means it's Paul Keel's time right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. The voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes joins us each and every week. Paul, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Bob. I'm doing good. How are you?
I am good. Other than the outcome of the game, I had all the confidence in the world last night that we'd bring a championship to Ohio and to the city of Cleveland out there before one was brought to the north side of Chicago, but it just wasn't meant to be.
No, it wasn't, and what a great season for the Indians. And, you know, I'm a Reds fan, but I wanted to see an Ohio team win it. And just so impressed with Terry Francona, not only with how he manages that team, but how he handles situations like defeat. And, you know, that game last night was a real sign of the Indians team that didn't give up, created some of their own mistakes. And more than anything, and as you said, Bob, giving credit to those who won, I think in those last three games, we finally saw the Chicago offense come to life that it didn't in the first three games of the series.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, sometimes the better team ends up coming out on top, even if you have them by the throat. And they did at 3-1, but there's a reason why the Cubs won 103 games. They were the best team in baseball from start to finish, and that's the way it ended. All right, let's talk about some of the best teams in football, the Ohio State Buckeyes, of course. Paul, you know, a victory, of course, 24-20 before we get ahead to Nebraska. Let's look back to Saturday in Northwestern. 24-20 win, and critics would say, yeah, still not a very glamorous victory, still not a very solid or complete victory. And really for a month now, going back to the Indiana game, and we all know about the Hoosiers and how much trouble they've given the Buckeyes. Then the overtime win over to Wisconsin, the loss to Penn State, and an underwhelming 4-point win over Northwestern. Folks are asking, is this one of the four best teams in the country? Is this a team that is destined at the end of it all to get into the college football playoff? Or is this last month kind of really, you know, putting a spotlight on some chinks in the armor?
Well, I think first and foremost, Bob, we got to give Northwestern credit. And seeing them in person much more than watching them on TV and everything else, very, very impressed with what they did, especially on offense. But, you know, to answer the other part of your question, is this one of the four best teams in the country, Ohio State? Not right now. Could they be? Certainly. You know, and I think what this team did was showed some of their real savvy in being able to win that game. Getting tough on defense when they need to be in that last drive, holding Northwestern, part of which was their own doing with a penalty, holding them to a field goal rather than a touchdown that would tie the game. And then Ohio State, you know, on offense, we saw them get off to a fast start in this game, which they hadn't done all year, with success in their first three drives. We saw them put together that last scoring drive that led to that Curtis Samuel touchdown pass. And then to get the football back at the end of the game and be able to grind the clock out, be able to keep it away from the opponent. And that crucial third down run by JT Barrett, not only gaining 30-some yards, but going down inbounds to keep the clock moving. So this is one of those in a couple of weeks we may not think about the fact that it was just a 4-point win against a team that maybe we're not that alert on, but, you know, coming off of a defeat, this was something this football team needed very badly, something that gave them a shot in the arm at confidence, and hopefully something they can build on going into what could be an even tougher game this coming Saturday night.
I have no doubt that it'll be an even tougher game. Obviously, Nebraska still very, very highly regarded because they were an undefeated team when they went to Camp Randall and met up with Wisconsin last week, came up on the short end and are still a top 10 team because I think people realize how solid that team is and how tough it was to play you know, at Wisconsin, as Ohio State found out in that overtime win as well. What do you see when you look at the Cornhuskers?
Well, and to all of the points you just mentioned, I think that helps validate Ohio State's win over Wisconsin.
Amen.
But Nebraska is much like the Badgers, a team that's going to beat you up, a team that's going to be physical. Certainly Tommy Armstrong has really developed as a quarterback. You know, the last time Ohio State played them, he was not playing. And what they're doing offensively is taking advantage of not only his abilities, but, you know, a couple of tailbacks that have given him quality play and a number of different receivers that can be very dangerous out there. Defensively seems to be where they've made their biggest turnaround from last year. And remember, when Mike Riley took over, this was a program that last year lost so many close games. But, you know, they were one of those 5-7 teams that got to a bowl game, posted a nice win over USC, or I think it was USC, and really seemed to generate some momentum from their bowl game and have come in and, you know, I think there were some questions going into last week because their schedule maybe hadn't been as daunting as everybody thought.
Right.
You know, their win over Oregon maybe lost some value because of Oregon's difficulties. But even in defeat last week, this was a football team that showed you that they could be dangerous. They're a very strong fourth quarter football team. And defensively, they have 15 interceptions, so they certainly can swing the momentum of the way they play on the defensive side of the ball.
Let's dig a little deeper there, Paul, and talk about the passing game for the Buckeyes against that ball-hawking Cornhusker secondary, because that's been the, you know, I don't want to say the problem, you know, when you're still winning and then the Buckeyes are still, you know, a highly ranked team and are still being successful, but the passing game hasn't been what the passing game, I guess, people want it to be. It's been up and down. It was even up and down a little bit in the win over Northwestern. A beautiful opening drive, for example, in which they went, 96 yards in 9 plays. And I think JT was 5 out of 6 on the drive. And it looks like, boy, we're clicking on all cylinders. But it got stagnant in the second half. And it's kind of hard to figure out why it is an up and down thing. So that's the challenge, being able to move the ball down the field with big plays against, as you just described, a very, very greedy Nebraska secondary.
Well, we got a small dose of what we've all been looking for with that pass late in the game to KJ Hill. And really, I think Noah Brown, with that career game he had against Oklahoma, he's become a little bit of a marked man now. And really, this young receiving group hasn't had a couple of guys separate themselves. Now, I think the good news that came today, it sounds like Paris Campbell is going to play. There was some concern he wouldn't after last week. And, you know, you just hope that these young guys, now that they're this deep into the season, the physical toll has maybe taken a little bit of an effect on them, that they can start to do some of the things they need to do. And, you know, for the first time really since he's been playing on a regular basis, the last couple of weeks, we've seen JT Barrett miss on some throws. Not a lot, but just a few. But the good sign is the offensive line protected a lot better last week. And you know, we know what we're going to get from JT Barrett. You know that he's not going to miss throws in an abundant number, but hopefully what will, and here's the other thing that's a little mind boggling, Bob. This receiving group in the first month of the season, they showed us all of the things that we're now looking for. You kind of expect it out of a young group. You see it earlier rather than sooner, and we're seeing it a little bit later now. Hopefully, whatever it takes, they can kind of snap out of it, and hopefully the ability to run the football will be able to also make defenses have to be a little more honest.
We are talking with the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, Paul Keels, this afternoon right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Buckeyes and number 10, Nebraska, number 10 in the AP poll, number 9 in the coaches poll. And I want to talk more about rankings in a minute. But on the other side of the ball for the Buckeyes, I kind of want to ask you about Raekwon McMillan, because a lot of people are looking at the numbers and they're saying, you know, for being one of the most highly rated defensive players in the country coming into this season and the rock in the middle of the Ohio State defense, it's kind of pedestrian. 51 tackles, 2.5 tackles for losses, and no sacks thus far. He had 9 tackles against Northwestern. And he was asked during an interview last week about this. I think it was last week, or maybe it was earlier this week. Yeah, maybe I think it was earlier this week since the Northwestern game, and about his performance, and he said, "If I ask all of you, I'm playing the worst season in the world," end quote. So I think he's hearing some people kind of questioning, hey, where's that productivity? Do you think it's valid, the criticism, Paul? And what do you make of his response to it, if it is or it isn't?
I'm not so sure I think it's valid, Bob, and here's why. I think there have been enough other players on that defense that have made plays, and what he's done with the way he's played in the middle, it's funneled some things in other directions. And we've seen Jerome Baker, who's taken over as a starter, make a lot of plays. That defensive line as a group have done an awful lot of things. and the secondary has played at a very high level. You know, what we're not seeing from Raekwon McMillan are the big spectacular plays that we saw him make the last couple of years. I don't know that he's doing anything wrong. I don't know that he's not performing. It's just, you know, we've not had to call his name an awful lot. You know, he hasn't had interceptions. He hasn't been a guy with big sacks. The good news is we did see his, you know, I think it was 9 tackles or whatever it was last week.
Yeah.
He was more of a factor there. But, you know, Raekwon McMillan is also he's one of the few players that we've gotten a chance to be around a fair amount. He's very humble. He's very team-oriented. And he's one of those guys that all he's concerned about is the team winning. But this is a guy that's got great natural skill. And think about it. As a true freshman, he ends up becoming a starting middle linebacker on a team that wins a national championship. So I think it's just a matter of the plays haven't come his way, and what he's done is he's influenced them going in other directions. So I don't know that it's that he's not doing anything. It's just other guys are making plays.
Yeah, and it may be, as you point out, it may be because of the influence he has and the blocking schemes that are designed to make sure that he is taken out of a play, which frees up a lot of other guys. Paul, a couple of quick questions on national stuff. One, the Big Ten going to start playing on Friday nights now. It was just announced yesterday, at least that's first I saw it, that the Big Ten is going to play on Friday nights. Apparently Urban Meyer and the Buckeyes are just fine with that. They'll play and they'll host games on Friday. At least two Big Ten teams, including Michigan and Penn State, have said, forget about it. We don't want anything to do with Friday nights, at least hosting them. We might be open to playing a road game once in a while on a Friday night, but I got to tell you, I'm not a huge fan of the idea. I know the reason why they want to do it, and I know why there might be a lot of positive reasons for some of the lesser-known schools in the Big Ten to get some national TV exposure on a Friday night, but I'm not a big fan of this. What are your thoughts on it?
I would agree with you, and I know Urban Meyer has been asked about it, but he hasn't really, at least up to the time that we did our call-in show with him, hadn't had a chance to digest it a lot. The other thing that came out, Gene Smith indicated that it would not happen for Ohio State next year as far as a home night game. Now, the one to keep an eye on, Bob, Ohio State opens the season next year at Indiana on Labor Day weekend, so keep an eye on that one possibly ending up on a Friday night. But I don't like the idea. I think that it causes a number of problems. It limits recruits coming to your games because they're playing in their high school football games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not Ohio State, Michigan, or Penn State, but it potentially challenges attendance at other places. You know, and it's just one of those things. You know, I think over the Labor Day weekend, we've seen some of that. And I know what the Big Ten has said is they're talking about September or October. But not a fan of it. And I can understand where the TV networks are coming from a little, because the Friday night concept, when it started a number of years ago, is where Boise State really got on the national spotlight. And some of the schools in their conference, and the Pac-12 has done a little more of it now, but it's later in the evening when, you know, here in the East and the Midwest, high school games are done. I'm not necessarily a fan of it. I'm not necessarily a fan of all of these night games on Saturdays. But that's just being an old fart that likes Saturday afternoons, and then that also has to travel and get home late from some of them. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And I'm really not convinced, Bob, that those schools that get lesser attendance, that it's really going to help them that much, especially if they struggle.
Yeah, and I don't think that the attendance is going to be their biggest concern. I think they just like the idea. I think a Purdue that isn't on national TV on ABC every week, or really almost any week, would like to be on national TV on a Friday night. And I just picked Purdue out because one of the teams that are kind of still in the bottom half of the conference. But
sure,
the schools might like the recognition. But the two things that I have with Paul, that's what, you know, these weeknight games have been kind of reserved since we started playing football pretty much 7 days a week now in some form or another for the, you know, the Mid-American Conference, the MAC schools, like, of course, we have, you know, here in Toledo with the Rockets and with Bowling Green. And I don't like them being upstaged by the Big Ten or other Power Five conferences holding their games on weeknights. And then the second part of that is I don't really like all of the games on the weeknights. I feel like there's football oversaturation that might be starting to be felt. A lot of people are wondering why the NFL ratings are in such steep decline as they are. And one of the things that a recent survey that Seton Hall University, I think, conducted was oversaturation of football in general. If you have it on 5 nights a week during the week and then it's there on the weekends, it's just not a, you know, it's not as rare a commodity anymore as it used to be.
No, not at all. And I know that, you know, the MAC in November has gotten big on the weeknights. And, you know, maybe a little of it is good for the exposure, but look at the stands too, Bob. Some of those MAC games. Are you getting the kind of crowds that you would get on a Saturday?
No, you're not.
You know, No, you're not. And so, and you know, now maybe if you're playing on Tuesday or Wednesdays or Thursdays, that still gives you the opportunity for high school kids to visit. But, and maybe we're just of that generation. We're accustomed to high school Friday, college Saturday, NFL Sunday. So, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I really don't think it's going to affect Ohio State to a large degree. Mm-hmm. You may see, you know, if this comes through the way they've talked about, you may see it on a rare occasion. But the first time they play a Friday night game at Ohio State, I think there's going to be a lot of us that'll be interested to see what the attendance is and what, if any, backlash comes from the high schools.
Paul Keel's joining us. One more question, Paul. I said we'd circle back to rankings one more time before we were done. So let's do that. Tuesday night, the first college football playoff ranking came out, for what it's worth. If there was going to be a one-loss team to leapfrog undefeated Washington into the top four, I would prefer it be Ohio State. I would have expected it to be Louisville, and it wasn't either one. It was Texas A&M. What was your response or your thought when you found out about that top four on Tuesday night and what it says about the committee's thought process?
Well, I was surprised, Bob, and I have to feign ignorance. I don't know that much about what Texas A&M has done this point. I've only paid a little bit of attention to Washington from a distance, so I'm a little surprised that Washington was leapfrogged. But, you know, here's the thing, and you kind of couched it the same way. I think you take it with a grain of salt because if you remember, in 2014, the first poll that came out, Ohio State was 13th. We know what ended up happening that year.
That's a great point. It's a very good point, and it really doesn't mean a whole lot. But what it does give you at least perhaps is some sort of a look-see inside the mindset of the committee. You know, what are they thinking as they make this decision, and how might that impact their future decisions? And for A&M, and I'm sure you realize, you know, their only loss is to Bama, so maybe they're an undefeated team if they don't play the world's greatest team ever, which Alabama gets kind of, you know, credit for being. But still, they did have that loss, and Washington is sitting out there. They had just beaten a top 20 team, number 17 Utah, and they're undefeated. And to see them leapfrog like that, it kind of says to me it's not necessarily going to be about best records, that if they think a one-loss team, or even, dare say, if it's the right two-loss team, is one of the top four teams in the country, they will leapfrog them over potentially a team with only one loss or no losses, and maybe even a team that's a conference champion.
Yeah, two losses is going to be the big obstacle to overcome, Bob. I think that's the one that's going to be difficult. I think if you're looking even at a one-loss team that doesn't get into their conference championship game, that, from what we've been told, that might carry a little bit of weight. The good news for Washington, and even the good news for Ohio State, and the good news for Nebraska, with what those schools have in front of them, there's the opportunity to reverse that. If Washington takes care of what they need to, and they get to a Pac-12 championship game and win that, with everything they've done, you've got to think that it would be hard to leave an undefeated Washington.
Yeah, yeah, it would. But I'll tell you,
you know what I mean?
I don't think the two-loss thing is a great disqualifier. Again, as I said, if it's the right two-loss team, meaning, for example, you got the showdown this weekend with LSU and Alabama. If LSU can beat Bear, right now they're 13th in the college football playoff rankings. If they beat Alabama, they jump massive up to probably the top five or six. And if they end up going on to win the SEC in the SEC championship game, that's going to be a two-loss LSU team that I promise you is going to be in the championship or in the
I think it depends on what happens with people like Nebraska, like Washington, and some others. I don't think it completely eliminates you, but I think with two losses, what that does is it puts you even in more of a situation where you're dependent on what happens with other people.
It might, and it'll be very interesting to see. I almost wish it to an extent, just out of sheer curiosity to see what
we could learn. Yes.
Yeah, because you know Alabama is going to be a one-loss team that'll still be in. Would they take a second SEC team if that SEC team, like LSU, had beaten Alabama and then went on to win the SEC championship game? Would they go with 2-1 conference over, say, an undefeated or a one-loss Pac-12 champion like Washington? I just feel like that weight of Alabama impacts everything, and that's why Texas A&M sits where they sit now. Their only loss was to Alabama. If you get a win over Alabama, then you're going to be elevated even with that two losses, at least in the minds of those committee members. And let's be honest, they're the only ones who matter.
And I think that's where the Big Ten was hurt, with Ohio State losing and also with Nebraska losing. Even though Nebraska still has an opportunity to gain a lot of value, I think what the Big Ten was hoping is they could potentially get to where they could have two undefeated teams coming into the Big Ten championship game.
Paul, I don't want to wrap this interview with a down note, but I do want to just kind of give you a second to offer your thoughts on the passing of John Hicks. You and I spoke about him this just the other day. Well, I think maybe it was last week or the week before in our weekly conversation, and we talked about Heisman Trophy candidates that are not quarterbacks and running backs. And you jumped up with John Hicks, of course, who was second in the Heisman, and we're, of course, paying great tribute to his career. And now, of course, we pay tribute to his life.
You know, we knew it was coming from everything we had heard, and you know, John was up in the booth next to ours at the Bowling Green game. A guy that was impressive in stature, impressive with his play, but, and I think I mentioned it to you when we talked about it, Bob. One of the most impressive things about John Hicks, when Jack Tatum took ill, and when Jack Tatum, it was looking like he was going to have both legs amputated, John Hicks was the one that stood up and tried to rally support from former players and in this community. A big, big loss. A man that will be missed in so many different ways. They're going to pay tribute to him Saturday, which is nice, but we were all better for having been around him just a little bit.
Absolutely. And prayers and condolences to his family and friends and everybody who bleeds scarlet and gray and on the loss of John Hicks. Paul Keels, voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, will have the call, of course, and you'll hear it right here of the Buckeyes and Nebraska on Saturday. Paul, thanks so much. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
You got it, Bob. Take care.
You too. Thanks so much. There you go. Paul Keels joining us. We're going to continue the college football theme this hour of the extravaganza because the BG Falcons lost another rough one, taken apart last night by on Tuesday, by Northern Illinois. So we're going to have Mike Jinks, the head coach of Bowling Green football, coming your way. We had Jason Candle yesterday, of course, prior to last night's Toledo win over Akron. So we stay with our MAC friends, and Mike Jinks will be joining us next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Jim Kushlin here. Time to continue the college football theme. We talked a little Buckeyes earlier. Now it's time to talk to Bowling Green Falcons. They fell the other day at Northern Illinois, 45-20. They're now 1-8 on the season, still winless in the Mid-American Conference. And help us talk all things Bowling Green Falcons football related. We welcome in once again the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Mike Jinks. Hi, coach. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, Jim. You?
Not too bad. I think we're all a little tired here on this Thursday, but we'll all push through. 45-20, the final out in DeKalb the other day. Their quarterback throws a career-high 5 touchdown passes. And in a game that, you know, I still thought you guys, you know, showed some heart. And as you've said many times over the course of the season as we've talked, Coach, that at least this team is working. They're not quitting and things like that. And I at least saw that despite the loss.
Right, we continue to fight, but Jim, you know, it is what it is, and we got to face the reality of the situation, and that you are what your record says you are, 1-1-8 football team, and not going to shy or back away from that. We will get this thing going the right direction. We will continue to develop the kids we have on campus. We're going to recruit our tails off. We've got a vision, we've got a dream, and we're going to do a great job of selling it, and we will be champions again.
Now let's talk about some of those guys that you've been playing, some of those younger guys. We talked a lot about him, but let's start with James Morgan, 224 yards, 3 touchdowns, did have the pick. He's still progressing. That's the nice thing that I've been seeing out of him. You know, he's progressing each week, and that's kind of what you're looking for, I would say.
No doubt. He's regressing each week. We're throwing more and more on him. Jim, it's just little things. Little things like manipulating the snap count. The last couple of games, if anybody's watched this play, you know, it looks like our tackles are having trouble blocking the defensive ends. A lot of that has to do with the quarterback changing up the snap count. You know what I mean? And just not getting in the rhythm. So there's a lot on this plate. We've increased the game plan from week to week. NIU did a great job of mixing up the coverage. It's probably one of the first teams that's been consistent in doing that this year. Caused some issues, but, you know, he made his share of great throws too. So again, you're right. He is improving, and I think when it's all said and done, he's going to be one of the better players in the MAC.
I could definitely agree with that. And over the course of this season, Coach, at least with him, what's the biggest thing you've noticed his improvement on since, say, the beginning of camp or when he first took over as starter to now?
Well, really, just settling down a little bit and you know, not throwing everything 100 miles per hour. The thing that he's done a much better job of is some of those underneath throws or some of those checkdowns, James would still try to throw it through the guy's chest. He's done a better job of developing some touch on his underneath balls. I think a lot of times with the young quarterbacks, they drop back there when they throw the deep ball. Even they want to see how far and how pretty they can throw it. And those are some of the things that he did earlier on in spring camp and in fall camp. And as this season has gone on, I think you've noticed we started to catch on some of these, what you like to call shots or down the football field. And because of the work he's put in and just a kid being coachable.
Talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. And one thing that he's at least had offensively, we'll get to some of the other younger guys here in a second, but even in a situation like this, it's nice to have that veteran leadership. And on offense, you still got at least a couple of guys who sport that, seniors Fred Coppett and Ronnie Moore. Talk to me about their season so far, overall, their final campaigns as Falcons, and what their veteranship means to the rest of the clubhouse.
Well, I tell you what, and we'll start by saying this: they have both been unbelievable in the clubhouse. You know, as far as out on the football field, Ronnie's been banged up a lot of the year. He's been in and out of a couple of games. You know, we asked Ronnie to move from inside receiver to outside receiver because of a need. He's done a great job of accepting that role, and it's been different for him. It's been a challenge, but he's handled it like a professional. You know, and then Fred Coppett has been steady. You know, I mean, he's been steady. He's been, when I mean steady, I don't mean average. I mean, he's been the leader of our football team from day one. You know, we've been in a lot of these games, and then solely because not only his play on the football field, but how he's led these guys and will not allow them to get down and feel sorry for themselves off the football field.
Talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. Back to some of the other kids, the younger guys out there, such as guys like Scott Miller, the sophomore. So what I like, for example, is you have some of that veteran leadership to pass some things along to the younger guys as they're getting experience. And Scott is one of the few guys, especially that receiving core, that's going to be catching balls from Morgan for a few years, hopefully. They're showing improvement as the season goes on as well.
Yeah, there's definitely some chemistry there. And again, and it goes back to putting the work in. It's not just happening. Those two guys are out there throwing extra balls all day long. Like I said, James done a great job of getting, you know, you've seen T.O.'s production kind of improve over the last couple of weeks because they're out there and they're working their craft. And I'm not just talking in that hour and a half, 2 hours that we practice. They're out there getting the extra throws in, getting that extra time in. And then if you're going to be prolific at this stage, those are the things that you have to do. And you know, and that's one of the positives at the end of the day. When I open up my window out here and we're done from practice and we're going to break down video, those guys are staying there and they want to be great. They want to get this place back to the level that it's been before. So, we'll get there.
Turning to the defensive side of the ball now, Coach, and if there's a couple of numbers that maybe cost you guys in this Northern Illinois game, the two that jump out at me, Northern Illinois went for 286 yards on the ground and 9 of 15 on third downs. Usually when you see numbers like that from an opposing team's running game and third down efficiency, it usually doesn't spell good things.
No, you're usually in trouble, and we've got to improve there, period. You know, we've got to do a better job of mixing up some of our coverages and making it a little bit more difficult on some of the opposing quarterbacks. So you're absolutely right. Those are areas that we definitely need to improve in.
Defensively overall, and this, you know, just like offensively, you're getting a lot of the younger guys playing time and experience. And it seems to me that that's been at times the rougher go getting these guys used to it. And hey, you know, to a certain degree, I've always said the way in the college game, the offenses are always going to be farther ahead defensively, especially if you compare it, say, to the NFL, guys who've been, you know, running those defensive systems and are experts at it for 10 plus years. It doesn't usually translate like that. No matter what type of program you are on the college level, but I imagine just like offensively, Coach, there's been some players and some things that they have improved on as the season has gone on.
Yeah, you know, Jamari has improved greatly. You know, the little Tyreek Jones, other kid that's come in, we're hoping to redshirt. He's a freshman. I think he's got 3 or 4 sacks now in conference play. But you hit it right on the head. You know, in today's college football world, offenses are tough to stop. They really are. But at the end of the day, with separating these average football teams to some of your conference contending conference championship football team is defense. And we can talk here about tempo offense, Falcon fads, all that we want to talk. At the end of the day, if we're going to improve and we're going to get to where we want to go, we have to play sound, great, physical defense. And that is the mission that I'm on.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza. A couple of games left at Akron, then a couple of home games, Kent State and Buffalo. Obviously, other than the obvious, coach, of trying to win every one of those games if possible, outside of that, what would you say from your standpoint as coach would be something you guys could shoot for as a goal for the remainder of the season, other, again, than the obvious of trying to win as many of these last three games as possible?
Hey, you know, to get to where we want to go, Jim, and I'm not just saying it, it's truly how I approach everything. It's win the day, man. Win the day. And to make sure these kids have that kind of mindset for the next 3 weeks. And make sure that we're not going out there and grab-tailing, for lack of a better word, and make sure we're going out there with a purpose to get work done and improve that day.
In other words, effort. At least continue to show the effort that they've shown all season.
Right. We'll do that, or they won't be on the football field. They're gonna play with great effort. But what I mean is, you know, when things get down and you get in these situations, and unfortunately I've been here before and always found a way through it. What you want to make sure you do when things like this start to happen, or when you have a losing season, and you've got. You know, you can't let that doubt seep into your football team, your program. You can't hear that outside noise. You're always going to have people starting to feel sorry for themselves. You're always going to have that parent or that fan or whatever telling, hey, coach, I'm screwing you over. You should be getting more playing time, this, that, and other. You got to shut that out. You got to understand that we're a football team, we're a family, and we work and we grind for one another. So that's where we are right now, and that is our focus.
Well said, coach. Head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons joining us here on the Extravaganza. Falcons fall against Northern Illinois, but up next, a Wednesday road tilt, the final road tilt for the Falcons. They'll finish the season with a pair at the Doit. It's Akron, the Zips in Akron. They just got throttled by the Toledo Rockets yesterday, so they're looking to try and keep pace, as they've had a decent season, relatively speaking, for their program. They've had a decent season, and they're right up there with Ohio near the top of that East Division. Tell me some of the things they do well and what you guys hope to do to stop them.
Well, they're very athletic, Jim. They've got a little quarterback that can beat you with his feet and with his arm. They've got a skill set that's as talented as any in the conference at this point. You know, right now they're 5-5 football team. Toledo did run away from them last night, you know, but early in that ball game, they were hanging with them score to score. They kind of wore them down a little bit in the second half. They're undersized defensively on the defensive front. They do a lot of different things on the back end, so we're going to have to be patient. We're going to have to be able to run the football, because, you know, again, that's one of the things that Toledo was able to do. That's one of the things that Buffalo was able to do in their upset win versus them, and you know, take advantage of you know, our strengths, for lack of a better word, and really, second fold, to keep their offense off the football field.
Now that you've also, by the way, played one game, and obviously they'll continue, your opinion of the so-called Maction, all these weekday games. I know we've gone over the part about how it kind of makes you guys, force you guys to rearrange your schedule a little bit, but now that you've been through one of them, tell me about it. Your thoughts on the overall concept of the Mid-American Conference playing these weekday games.
Well, the concept, I mean, you know, from a financial standpoint, it was brilliant. And not just that, it's just, you know, notoriety for our league and for our coaches and for our football players, puts them on a national stage, throughout the month of November. So, it's really an honor to be a part of it. It does make for an interesting week, getting out of here, on a Monday night, Monday morning to play a Tuesday ball game kind of throws things for a loop, but, exciting to be a part of.
It's the Akron Zips taking on the Falcons in Akron coming up on Wednesday. We'll have it for you, of course, here on the Ticket. I've tried to put as many of the weekday games on 106.5 as I can. This will be one of them. 7 o'clock, the pregame time for the 8 o'clock kick next Wednesday, the 9th, Bowling Green at Akron. Best of luck for that one, coach, and hopefully we're talking the end of this losing streak when we reconvene next time.
Appreciate you, Chris.
That is head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons taking some time to join us here on the Extravaganza. And obviously, you know, that to me is the biggest thing. And that's why I wanted to ask, you know, coach that. You know, the Falcons are 0-5, 1-8. And he said it perfectly. You know, at this stage, you are what your record says you are. And we know that the Bowling Green Falcons have struggled. We know there won't be any defending of the conference title or division title or even going back to a bowl game for that matter with eight losses there. Already ineligible for a bowl game this season. They will not be bowl eligible, obviously. So, it's about effort. And obviously, you want to win as many of these last three games. And to a small degree, they're going to be tougher at Akron than home games against Kent State and Buffalo. But it's an effort thing, too. And at least there is still that. If you're a Falcons fan this year, yes, they're 1-8. And at times, it's probably been a little painful to watch. But the effort's still there, and I love how they're getting all these young guys, both offensively and defensively, into the fold, getting them that necessary game experience. I mean, I completely agree with Coach, for example. James Morgan, as he continues to grow, is going to turn into one of the better quarterbacks in this entire league, and in the next year or two, when the Falcons can start fresh and get another infusion of talent through recruiting in here, I think we'll turn the corner, and they'll continue to have a solid offensive game, but you're going to have those growing pains in a season like this. That is just what it is at this point. And for the Falcons, it's obviously going to be a season that they're going to deep down want to forget, but there are important things that are going on right now, and most of them involve getting these young guys, offense and defense, both sides of the ball, that experience they need so that when they're sophomores and juniors and seniors, they know those situations and they'll know how to handle them better than when you're a freshman. That's just the physics of football in a way right there. And that'll be all the more beneficial in a future season in the next year or two when the Falcons can start fresh. And I think we'll be right back up there because I still see no indication as of this moment that suddenly there's going to be a juggernaut emerging in the East Division, say the way Northern Illinois has been these last few years in the West. I don't see a type of team like that emerging from the East. You'll still have the Ohio Bobcats and so on, maybe an Akron wants to make noise. Maybe someday the Miami Redhawks will pull out of the funk that they're in. But as long as the East Division is wide open, that helps a Falcons team that'll have these young guys going. They're your freshmen or sophomores now that'll become sophomores and juniors next year, and they'll know what it's like in the game experience as opposed to just bringing them fresh from a reserve role that they may have been in. So that there are positives even in a season where the Falcons are 1-8. That's going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza. Stick around for Drive Time coming up next, and then it's Thursday, so that means we'll have Thursday night NFL to kick off Week 9, Atlanta at Tampa. That's an 8 o'clock pregame time right here on 106.5 The Ticket. So we got all that going for you. Then a Football Friday tomorrow here on the Extravaganza. So enjoy the evening.